Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to Slate Money, your weekly guide to the important business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion in New York, and on the show this week, the Supreme Court decided the fate of Aereo, an internet television streaming service. We'll dive into dark pools amid allegations that Barclays put its profits ahead of its customers. Imagine that. And we'll also tell you why lots of rich people are spending at least 183 days a year in Puerto Rico. I think you can probably guess. And last but certainly not least, we'll close with the numbers lightning round as we do every week. First, let me introduce regular guest Kathy O'Neill, head of the lead program for data journalism at Columbia University. Hello, Kathy. What's your number this week?
My number is 0.25.
That's a low number. And we also have Slate's own Moneybox columnist, Jordan Weissman. Jordan, I'm assuming that your number is going to be bigger than one quarter.
Yes, it will be. It's going to be 11,000.
11,000. My number is 300 million, so I beat both of you by a few orders of magnitude. We are going to start with Aereo. It falls to me to try and explain what's going on here. Probably many of you lovely listeners have used Aereo, or at least heard about it. It's a clever little service where you can watch television, broadcast television, on your phone or your computer, and broadcast television is free. And what Aereo does is says, well, we'll just pick it up for free. We'll give you your own little aerial. We'll have great reception. You're not going to be stuck in the Manhattan Canyon somewhere. And then you get to watch whatever that aerial picks up whenever you like. And we'll charge you $10 a month for the convenience. Seems like a nice idea, but the Supreme Court slapped it down, said that this was a copyright violation, said that the broadcasters own the copyright of their work, they can control who rebroadcasts their work, and that Aereo was in effect rebroadcasting their work, and that if it wanted to do that, it would need to get permission from the broadcasters. So, Kathy, what do we think about this?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there's it brings up a lot of questions, one of them being, to what extent does the Supreme Court understand technology? And a lot of the different reporting on this decision have differed about the technology, like wherewithal of the Supreme Court. Another question it brings up related to that is the extent to which a service rendered for a person can be considered stealing. I mean, you know, in other words, if I hired someone to come to my house and turn on my television for me whenever I wish, then that would be fine. But since they're doing something like that at some distance, it's not fine.
And so the answer to your question is, and I've read the decision, which came with a blistering dissent by Antonin Scalia. Does Antonin Scalia ever write dissents which aren't blistering?
I was about to say, you were getting a little redundant.
But what we're really looking at here is two ways of looking at the law. There's the spirit of the law and the letter of the law. And I think the Supreme Court absolutely does understand technology. And it absolutely does understand the loophole that Aereo was trying to take advantage of. It does understand that it's silly on its face for Aereo to have hundreds of thousands of tiny little aerials just to get around the letter of the law and find this loophole. And what Scalia says is, hey, congratulations, you found a loophole. What you're saying is this sort of reductio ad absurdum argument, which says, well, if this is okay, then that must be okay. It's a very logical way of looking at things. Whereas what the majority said was, it's absolutely clear what's going on here, that once upon a time, the cable TV channels would just take the broadcast channels. The cable TV operators would take the broadcast channels off the air for free, send them out to their subscribers, make lots of money. The broadcasters took them to court and lost. And because they lost, they then got Congress to change the law and say, oi, cable companies, you're not allowed to do that. And it's very clear that the spirit of that law in 1976 was, you're not allowed to do that, which is exactly the thing that Aereo was doing.
So here's what I think is, I think you're right, Felix. I think you're characterizing it very well. What was interesting to me about this is that the Supreme Court kind of took it upon themselves to close this loophole, right? They saw, okay, Aereo did find this, but in reality, you're really acting like a cable company, essentially. The problem is that that's not really a good way to go and make court decisions or to kind of make law as a court. You don't want the Supreme Court to be in the role of closing loopholes because it opens up all these other potential ramifications for other technologies. What you really want is a repeat of what happened back with the cable companies and have Congress step in and say, no, you are specifically not allowed to do X through legislation. That's a much better way to kind of regulate industry and make law rather than have essentially the Supreme Court try to deal with competing analogies or competing metaphors. The way this case was kind of argued was, is Aereo like a cable company rebroadcasting, or is it more like a guy coming and putting an antenna on top of your roof, so like you used to be able to do in the old days, so that you can come and pull down the signal? And it's really hard to say they're not doing that. I mean, most literally, that is what they're doing. It's a much more sophisticated version of that operation. So I think that's what a lot of people are very worried about right now, is that, you know, if Congress had gone and done this, you wouldn't have to be concerned about cloud computing at all. You wouldn't necessarily have to be concerned about, you know, what happens to your music if you want to put it in a storage lock or an online storage locker and replay it on different computers.
The Supreme Court, the majority opinion, did bend over backwards to say this is not some kind of important precedent which all cloud computing companies should be worried about.
Let me interject here for a moment. I'm going to echo what Jordan just said, and I just want to sort of speak even more meta for a moment. Like, as a data person, as a mathematician, law confuses me because it acts somehow on two different levels. That, like, decisions are made in a logical fashion where you're like, what does the law say? Let's go look at it. But it's also somehow relying on metaphor and precedent. And you don't know which one is taking precedent at what time. And it does seem like there's some ambiguity in this decision as to whether we're talking about metaphor because it's like a cable company, or whether we're talking about the letter of law, in which case it's not clear to what extent
this
applies.
There's no ambiguity at all. We're clearly not talking about the letter of the law. If we were talking about the letter of the law, then Scalia's side would win.
Absolutely would.
You know, we're creatures of the internet here in podcast-diverse, and the internet creatures hated this decision as a general rule, precisely because they tend to be a little bit more literal about things,
yeah.
And also because they love this idea that technology companies can be clever and do disruption and
right.
All of those wonderful internet-y things. I am sympathetic to them. I think that Aereo was providing a valuable service, that it ought to be able to provide that service, that that service ought to be legal. But at the same time, I know exactly what Congress was doing when it passed the Communications Act of 1976. And it's pretty obvious that what Aereo is doing is biting its thumb at Congress and saying, well, if you want to stop us, you're going to have to pass a law. My sympathies are with Aereo. I think it's a good company. My sympathies are not with Congress, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the broadcasting companies. And the broadcasting companies have a huge amount of power. They have hundreds of billions of dollars worth of spectrum, which they basically got given for free. And the only reason they're not all cable companies right now is because they want to hold that spectrum for ransom and make sure that the government pays them billions and billions of dollars for their spectrum, which they don't even own. So I have no sympathy for the broadcasters, but the broadcasters did win, and I do have a certain amount of sympathy for the majority, which found in favor of the broadcasters, because the spirit of the law does matter.
Yeah, you know, I feel what you're saying. At the same time, this just seems like, because we're talking about broadcasting, this was such a perfect case for the court to pull a classic, it's up to you, Congress, to really kick it back and say, this should not be a heavy lift for you guys. You know, if you really want to regulate this, there is an easy way for you to do it. But that's not what happened. And now the majority did bend over backwards to try and carve as narrow an opinion as possible. But sometimes narrow opinions have a way of expanding over time.
And I would like to just spend one second on thinking about what the next lawsuits are going to be. coming out of this? Like, are we going to have problems with cloud computing companies that store, you know, your pictures that you pulled off the web, possibly, you know, against the law? I mean, that's the fear.
We don't
right?
know. I mean, some creative attorney will try. We'll find out.
There will. I think what's happening in general in the technology world is that things which used to be real-world things governed by real-world law have become virtualized and are now happening in the cloud. And this is happening in a bunch of different ways. You can even think about what Uber is doing in this way, you know, that you used to have to go out on the street and raise your hand and hail a taxi using a physical device known as an arm, and now you just take out your, you know, phone and do essentially the same thing in a virtual way. And that, too, is a kind of loophole or regulatory arbitrage or whatever you want to call it, because there are lots of regulations surrounding who can stop and pick you up when you raise your physical arm, which don't apply when you're using your phone.
Never mind what's going to happen when you just think about a taxi.
There's going to be a lot of lawsuits around this, and I think you're right, Jordan, that the Supreme Court is placing itself in the position of, we are actually going to be deciding these things ourselves. We're not going to leave it to Congress to decide these things, which may or may not be a good thing, given Congress's ability to decide just about anything these days.
Speaking of lawsuits. I have a lawsuit to talk about.
Tell me about your lawsuit.
More lawsuits.
I like that segue. You get 10 out of 10.
I took charge. The New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman just filed a lawsuit, a civil complaint, on June 25th, complaining that Barclays has misled their clients, believe it or not. In particular, I know, the clients of Barclays wanted to invest their money somewhere, and Barclays convinced them to invest in, to trade in dark pools. Now, for those of you who don't know what dark pools are, they are basically off-exchange places to trade stocks. So instead of doing it on a stock exchange where everyone can see the prices, possibly not at the same time because some people have faster feeds than others, you would trade in a dark pool where no one gets to see what's going on really, and you have to trust that you're getting a fair price.
Well, okay, I'm going to push back on this characterization of dark pools. Dark pools are stock exchanges. They have to report every single trade to the aggregated stock ticker, just like every other stock exchange. And really, the only difference between a classic exchange and a dark pool is that the orders aren't visible. It's not the trades, it's just the orders. If you're putting in an order to buy 1 million shares of IBM on a stock exchange,
right,
then everyone can see that there's a huge buyer out there wanting to buy 1 million shares of IBM. And if they see that, what they do is they bid up the price because they know that there's this order there. If you put that trade into a dark pool, no one can see your order, and so people, this is the idea anyway, won't know that there's that big order out there, and so it's easier to buy that stock without the price moving against you.
Right. Okay. So thank you. There's a good reason to want to trade off, to not want to show your orders. Let's be careful. Namely, it's a classic thing to do if you're a trader, to see an order and pick people off, to basically say, oh my God, these people, probably some huge pension fund or money market fund wanted to buy a shit ton of Apple stock. I'm going to front run them. So you want to avoid that kind of thing. And people have all sorts of methods for trying to minimize the amount of that they're picked off. And it's, you know, there's all sorts of theories about it. Anyway, dark pools were supposed to be somehow an answer to that. And the idea was, here's a safe place for you to not get picked off. And by the way, there won't be lots of predatory traders picking you off there. And so that is the issue for this lawsuit.
And this was kind of at the heart of Flash Boys, right? This was what Michael Lewis was writing about. People were being lured into these dark pools, or I shouldn't say people, large institutional investors were being lured in under the pretense that this was a safe space where you could avoid predators who were coming to get your trade. And it turns out there were a whole bunch of high-speed traders sitting there ready to ping all of their orders in these dark pools. And that was what Flash Boys was about. In the Schneiderman lawsuit, rumors about it just happened to start circulating right around the time the press drive for Flash Boys came out. It's not shocking that a few months later it has finally kind of come down in court. But what's interesting to me here is how we have yet another instance of a New York State Attorney General doing his absolute best to try and get on the media train and try to get some attention and some political traction. And in the case of, you know, Schneiderman, he's probably the first AG since Spitzer who really doesn't have a clear political future. So I think when I saw that this lawsuit came out, or a clear political future beyond his current position, and I think it's a bad sign that when I saw this lawsuit come out, my initial reaction was less about how dare Barclays and more about, oh, well, he finally found his big suit. Like, you know, he's going to get in the headlines for a while now. Congratulations, Eric.
He is using the Martin Act, which is this New York state law, which there's no equivalent of it in any other state or at the federal level, which basically allows the New York Attorney General to prosecute just about anything on Wall Street. And so what you need to do, if we're judging to what degree this is showboating by the AG and to what degree this is genuinely egregious behavior by Barclays, is to look quite carefully at the complaint and say, well, yes, probably it's illegal under the Martin Act, because just about anything is illegal under the Martin Act. But is this worth having a major lawsuit like this? And looking at the complaint, I would say probably yes. I would say that what Barclays was doing was pretty clearly lying to their clients. And this is what Goldman Sachs got done for with the Abacus trade, and what virtually every major prosecution surrounding the financial crisis has been at heart, you lied to your clients, now you have to pay us a massive great fine. And this is just another way in which a big investment bank, in this case Barclays Capital, which used to be known as Lehman Brothers, was lying to its clients. And so, yes, come on, let's bring the suit.
Yeah, I agree they're lying to their clients, but I want to have two comments. First of all, it's not clear that how much their clients actually lost. They didn't actually...
No, the clients did not lose money. There's no assertion in the complaint that the clients lost money.
Right. So the complaint is you lied. So it's going to be hard to figure out, given that it's a civil complaint, what the fine is actually going to be. That's my first thing. My second, well, actually three things. The second thing is absolutely showboating. I think we all agree on that. But the other thing is, I think this was completely inevitable. Dark pools, as far as I could tell, like from the get-go, would need high-frequency traders, market makers, one way or another, to provide the liquidity that you actually need to get your things sold.
So let me come back and give a 30-second explanation of dark pools here. The idea is, the idea behind markets in general is they're a venue where you can match buyers and sellers, and that you have a whole bunch of buyers, you have a whole bunch of sellers, and then there's a clearing price at which they match and they meet, and that's where the transactions take place. And what inevitably happened when you had a market was that you would a bunch of intermediaries and market makers would grow up in between the buyers and the sellers, and they'd buy at one price from the sellers and they'd sell at a higher price to the buyers. And the buyers and the sellers both got a bit upset about this and said, why are we essentially paying a tax to the intermediaries to do this? Why can't we just be matched directly with each other? And dark pools were an attempt to do that. The idea was originally that you would just go in there with your order to buy 1 million shares of IBM, and then some other big institutional investor would put in an order to sell 1 million shares of IBM, and the dark pool would manage to match those two orders, and hey presto, you would just face each other and there would be no market maker in the middle. Great idea. Doesn't work in reality.
It doesn't work.
Because in reality, what institutional investors do is they all want to basically do the same thing at the same time. And what you need is some kind of liquidity provider, whether it's a market maker or a high-frequency trader, to take the other side of the trade. And the reason why Barclays was bending over backwards to be nice to the predatory high-frequency traders was precisely because those traders would give Barclays the kind of liquidity that it needed in order to be able to match as many trades as possible on its dark pool and make the dark pool the biggest dark pool in America, which is its stated aim.
Right. So what we saw in the complaint was that the high-frequency traders, the market makers, the ones that actually did the trades, weren't being charged at all for these trades, or very, very little. And, you know, it doesn't make much sense for Barclays to be letting predatory traders come in and make money off of them unless they need them for some reason. And the reason they needed them was liquidity. I claim that the entire concept of a dark pool is a marketing technique saying you don't like being picked off. We're going to put you in a place where we're going to pretend you're not getting picked off. And what they're getting in trouble for here is that marketing. And it was a sham marketing scheme. And they should get in trouble. But I'm just saying it was inevitable.
You know, I think there's also a lesson here more generally, just for any listeners who might be contemplating doing something borderline fraudulent or maybe messing with, maybe trying to pull one over on clients. keep it out of email. That's just always keep it out of your email. One of the reasons why they're in trouble is because there are actually messages from Barclays execs saying, well, I was kind of happy with the idea of being transparent with our clients, but if we're going to take liberties about who's on the other side of these trades, why the hell not?
Nah, I think that's the lesson of many of these cases, but this one, not so much.
Really?
No, seriously. What you saw in this case was reality rather than just emails.
Okay.
You had one report being prepared for an institutional client saying, oh, whoops, we've managed to route 85% of your orders to our own dark pool. His boss, the guy who was going to present this report to the client, his boss said, you really should take that number out.
Yeah.
Because the client doesn't need to know that. And he refused. He's like, no, this is my client. I'm working for my client. I'm going to tell him this 85% number. And then that was 2 days before the meeting.
Yeah.
The day before the meeting, he gets fired. And then he goes off to the attorney general and said, I've got some stuff to tell you about what's going on inside Barclays. The meat of the complaint came from extensive interviews with dozens of people who work or worked at Barclays rather than, oh my God, we found a smoking gun email.
There were, okay, that's fair enough. There were some smoking gun emails, though, on top of all else. I think, look, again, for anybody who is an aspiring white-collar criminal out there, I'm urging caution, just for the love of God. You know, this is really, really, you know, fraud 101. That's all.
Okay. Jordan,
yes.
Let's move on, and you can tell us about small Caribbean nations or small Caribbean islands.
Protectorates.
which are about to go bust.
Yes. So this week, Business Week had a longish article about the new generation of hedge fund billionaires, and not all millionaires, rich people who are moving to Puerto Rico to essentially avoid taxes. In 2012, sensing their economic desperation, the fact that they're behind, you know, facing, you know, doom from their debt payments or whatnot, the island's government passed a law that said if you live there for 183 days a year and you really live here, your family is here, your kids are here, there's a sign that you're actually part of the community, you will not have to pay taxes on your investment income. And if you're a hedge fund manager, you'll pay a reduced rate on your management fees. And as a result, first there were a few people who kind of made headlines for trying to make the move, but then they got caught up in the press gale. Finally, you're getting this group of people who are sort of pseudo expats. I think listeners might be expecting me to start railing against Puerto Rico and these people who are moving who don't want to pay their fair share to Uncle Sam. But what actually strikes me about this story is the tragedy of it. Because there's a line where one of these government officials says, we want to be the Singapore of the Caribbean. That's their plan. They want to attract these really wealthy people to try and somehow anchor the economy. And what that shows is that the people running Puerto Rico have absolutely no idea how development works. It's not going to work. It's bringing a billionaire. Singapore did not develop by bringing in billionaires. It established a manufacturing base through a lot of grit and hard work and position as a global, you know, a good position to be a global trade hub. Having a few rich guys show up and buy some luxury real estate and, you know, do some charity work isn't going to fix this island's problems. And so that's what really struck me about this story.
But let's be clear about what's going on here, because it's kind of astonishing, really. If you are a U.S. citizen,
yeah,
and you live anywhere on planet Earth, you need to pay U.S. federal income taxes on all of your global income.
Yeah.
Unless you live in Puerto Rico.
That's basically what's going on here. And I still, you know, I don't know, you know, at some point or another, I have to wonder if Puerto Rico pulling this is just going to fray it with Congress even further. It's a problem because Puerto Rico actually does rely on a lot of federal spending in terms of safety net benefits and things along those lines. Those help buoy its economy. But in the meantime, yes, they've turned themselves essentially into our own little Cayman Islands.
So I looked up a little bit more about Puerto Rico because we know about a year ago there's like all talk about Puerto Rico's going bankrupt and Wall Street made a lot of money, you know, lending money to Puerto Rico. In fact, $1.4 billion in fees from 2006 to 2013. Why did that happen? What is actually going on here? I don't know if you guys know this, but it turns out that in 1976, they declared that federal income tax were exempt for Puerto Rico. So that was done intentionally to attract businesses to move there, and it kind of worked, and it did work. But then it declared unfair in the mid-90s and phased out. And as it was phased out, businesses left because of the federal income, the federal taxes were not as pleasurable. So it was phased out, and then they didn't actually stop spending money. So then they started borrowing lots and lots of money through Wall Street. And they got into a lot of debt problems, and they're in desperation. They made new laws that got rid of taxes for capital gains and dividends, and that's what we're seeing now.
Well, the other thing that we have to explain here is that Puerto Rico is a desperately poor Caribbean island.
Yeah,
it has the per capita income associated with desperately poor Caribbean islands, not with America. It is much poorer than any U.S. state. It has much higher unemployment than any U.S. state. It has much higher obesity rates than any U.S. state. It has much lower education attainment than any U.S. state. It is a Caribbean island much more than it is a U.S. state. And at the same time, every Puerto Rican individual is a citizen of the United States. So if they are smart, if they are valuable on the job market. In fact, even if they're not smart, they can always make more money in Florida or New York or somewhere else than they can in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. So anyone with the ability to earn money leaves the island, which means that the people who are left are the people who have no ability to create any kind of economic activity at all. And so there's a big structural problem here of completely open borders with the U.S., and this just drain of all of the talent to the U.S. And this is not something which a tweak to the tax code is going to fix.
I mean, if you invite a few billionaires to a desperately poor island nation, that you're not building an economic base. You're building a banana republic, you know, right, at best. Yeah. And so that's...
And the people who are doing this, who are desperately cutting taxes and stuff, they're attracting only billionaires. They said, you know, on the record that what they want to do is juice the GDP for Puerto Rico, make it look better on paper. GDP is a poor proxy for the health of a nation, given that it's half as rich as Mississippi. My theory is that, you know, given the billionaires versus the very poor natives of Puerto Rico, we're going to have the revolution starting there.
Okay, are we holding you to it? Wait, how?
I mean, seriously.
Wait, like, no, we need a time
frame. It's like a perfect recipe.
Is this going to happen before or after Puerto Rico defaults? This is the other
after.
Big thing is that Puerto Rico has a massively unsustainable debt load, no way to service the debt, and also no way to legally restructure or default or do anything else on the debt. So once we get this whole Argentina thing out of the way, the next massive sovereign debt issue is going to be Puerto Rico.
Absolutely.
So what are the chances that during the 2016 election, a Puerto Rico bailout is going to be an issue?
The interesting thing is that a huge amount of the tax shenanigans going on in Puerto Rico are, in fact, a Puerto Rico bailout happening sort of underneath the surface is, you know, the tax revenues that aren't going to the federal government by dint of people being located in Puerto Rico are a stealth bailout of tax of Puerto Rico, which isn't really working very well.
But it's not exactly. It's a stealth bailout, but it's not going to the actual people. I want to just a little bit more evidence for my theory about the revolution. If you listen to the quotes coming from these asshole billionaires who are now living there, one of them was quoted as saying, "Now that I don't have to worry about taxes, I have a lot more time because I used to spend 30% of my time thinking about taxes."
Yep.
This is a person who spends their time counting their money. Like, what better target for the poor of Puerto Rico? If I'm in Puerto Rico and like I see the bailout going to those guys, I mean, how am I going to feel?
So you're telling me they're going to roast Scrooge McDuck?
I won't be surprised.
Puerto Rico is the new Cuba. You heard it here first. I am going to leave Puerto Rico there and move on to the numbers round. And I am going to start. Made an executive decision as the host of this podcast that this week we're going down rather than up. I'm going to start with my $300 million because my $300 million is actually related to helping out poor people in a way. It's the amount of money that the Red Cross claims to have spent on Hurricane Sandy in one form or another. The Red Cross was notoriously disastrous in its response to Sandy. It didn't get anywhere for the first week, and then it was just cumbersome and generally unhelpful most of the time. And yet it was also the charity which almost everyone gave to above and beyond anyone else. And so it wound up with all of this money, and for really stupid reasons, it promised that all of this money that was given after the event, long after it could be helpfully spent, would be spent on Hurricane Sandy and for Hurricane Sandy victims. And so ProPublica and various other people are interested in asking some questions, like, what happened to all of that money? Where did you spend it? And the response of the Red Cross to this perfectly sensible question of what happened to our $300 million is, that's a trade secret, and if we told you, that would place us at a competitive disadvantage against our competitors.
Wait, who's the Red Cross's competitor?
Exactly.
Occupy.
Well, Occupy Sandy is actually true. Occupy Sandy was an incredibly effective group of people who were very helpful when the Red Cross
and did
was
not
MIA
spend $300 million.
And did not spend, well, spent very little money. And in fact, one of the lessons of Occupy Sandy is that money is not the bottleneck. Money is not what you really need in these situations. But in any case, the Red Cross has hired Gibson Dunn, which is one of the most expensive law firms in the world.
That's how you know it's, but they called them the Marines.
to try and, what you might call, foil the foil, to push back against ProPublica's Freedom of Information request. Because what's happening is that the Attorney General, the New York State, knows where the money went, but isn't allowed, but the Red Cross is trying to prevent New York State from giving ProPublica that information. It's yet another data point against the Red Cross, and there are so many, but that one really stood out for me. Jordan, because Kathy has such a minuscule number, next.
Really? Wow.
So mine's not actually finance-related this week, but it is the number that stood out to me more than any other that I came across. So I just felt the need to share it. Also because I am, as has been said, the voice of the millennials on this podcast. This week, a journalist named Edward Champion wrote a 11,000-word essay titled Emily Gould, Literary Narcissism and the Middling Millennials. It is a screed unlike any I have encountered in the last several years, just focused on this one sort of minor literary celebrity.
What on earth, do you really have nothing better to do than read 11,000-word essays about...
No, this is all...
He's a millennial, man.
Yeah, this is all over my Twitter feed yesterday, man.
It's people.
There were some great pieces. There were some great excerpts here.
I'm blaming Twitter for this. We're moving on because we've already spent far too much time on this random thing. Kathy, 0.25.
Yeah, I even read a little bit because he tweeted it. And I couldn't read it. So 0.25, that's 25%. That's my back-of-the-envelope calculation for how many people who live in Detroit were living in a house in 2014 that was on the brink of foreclosure. That's one out of four people. That's a back of, as I said, back of the envelope, because what I found out, what there was a New York Times sort of beautiful picture of all these houses that were, it's 43,000 houses that were on the brink of foreclosure. There's 701,000 people there. I estimated there's about four people per house. And then I came up with that 25% figure. However, when I read on, I said that it's only one in 10 households. So what that means to me is there are very few people living in each house, or there's lots of vacant houses. And we know there's some vacant houses, but it's just giving you the idea of the scale of the desolation in the housing market in Detroit. It's really awful.
What happens to people in Detroit if and when they do get foreclosed upon? Do they generally leave the city entirely? Do they just move somewhere else? Do they wind up staying in the house anyway?
I don't know the actual figures, but the article did mention that there's so many people that are behind in their taxes on their houses that sometimes they just vacate the property and then buy a new house on auction and then start that cycle over again. I'm not saying that I know.
It makes sense. If you owe $5,000 in taxes on your house and you can buy the house next door for $1,000, you may as well just leave the lien on the house and on the old house and buy a new house.
And what does that do? So, it's an awful cycle.
Flaw in the system.
So, on which depressing note,
sorry,
we're going to end this week's podcast. We will have a slightly more upbeat 4th of July.
You could have started with me and the numbers.
I could have done, but the whole point is it's meant to be a surprise. I thought you were going to be happy. In any case, everyone, thank you for listening to Slate Money. If you like the show, please consider subscribing. We're easy to find. Just search for Slate Money in the iTunes store. And while you're there, do leave us a review. It will help spread the word. You can also write to us with your comments, complaints, praise, questions, slatemoney@slate.com. The producers for Slate Money are Stan Alcorn and Tracy Samuelson. The executive producer of Slate's podcasts is Andy Bowers. For Cathy O'Neill and Jordan Weissman, I'm Felix Salmon. Until next week.